welcome to the Threefold Social Order. This is your host, Stephen Joy, coming at you with an introductory episode for what is sure to be the best podcast you've ever heard. Well, who knows about that one, but here we are, so let's just do this thing. I suppose it's only fair to give you an introduction as to who I am. Well, you see, friends, that is a pretty simple question to answer. I have been a student of Rudolf Steiner for many years now. His work, his teachings, his lectures, etc. Long, long time. For those of you new to Steiner, everything is interconnected. Basically, everything you learn from Dr. Steiner's pen or his lecture series, etc., is a development of a basic theme of what the human being is. Thus, the body of people that gathered around him was called the Anthroposophical Society. Once again, many people may not be familiar with this, although many people will. So let me just do a quick explanation. Anthro, of course, refers to human being, and Sophia, of course, is an ancient term for wisdom. And so you put the two together and you get anthroposophical, which means the wisdom of the human being, one might say, or the wisdom that the human being is capable of achieving. Compare this, for example, to another term popular at the time in such esoteric circles as Dr. Steiner was writing and lecturing in, and that term is theosophy, and that is the wisdom of God, or the wisdom of divine nature, or wisdom of a divine nature. And in that case, you would have had wisdom as well, of course. There is plenty of wisdom in theosophy, but it is of a different stripe, one might say, than that found in anthroposophy. It's not necessarily that one is better than the other, but most people would agree, I think, that Dr. Steiner's approach is more cognizable, perhaps. I won't say more easily cognizable, but is, in the final analysis, more cognizable than the lion's share of theosophy. Having said all that, I don't want to get off into a tangent, but as many people will be approaching these terms for the first time in a real way, it's important to digress just slightly at the beginning and say that theosophy led by Helena Petrovna Blavatsky was established prior to Dr. Steiner's work. In fact, Dr. Steiner was briefly with the Theosophical Society. I shouldn't probably say briefly. He was there for some time and then eventually split off because of, you might say, irreconcilable differences between the two. By that time, Blavatsky had long since passed away. And to my knowledge, she and Dr. Steiner never met. I may be wrong about that, but the fact that I'm not stopping and spending 30 seconds to look it up on Google tells you that time is of the essence, because I really want to get this out before I leave for a trip. So, back to it. What is the threefold social order, and why is it uniquely a piece of anthroposophical knowledge, one might say, instead of theosophical knowledge? Well, anthroposophical knowledge, anything really that Dr. Steiner wrote or said or taught, etc., was framed in such a way that a modern human being with a scientific intellectual bent or mindset, i.e. someone who had grown up outside, say, the strictures of the Middle Ages' tendency towards religious understandings that flowed throughout much of the education up until, say, I don't know, the 1700s, 1800s. So what you'll find with Dr. Steiner is that whatever he's talking about, although it eventually all relates back to spirit, if you like, spiritual matters, he does it in an extremely modern intellectual you know, scientific way, one might say. It doesn't mean reading him is like reading a science book, but it means reading him is not at all like reading a religious book, you know, that asks people to believe in anything. Dr. Steiner was pretty famous among his students and his followers, the group around him, for saying something like, please don't believe what I'm saying. Rather, test it in your own intellect, test it in your own mind, work it out. And only then will you really be on firm ground to accredit it on your own as something worthwhile, as something true. So Dr. Steiner, it's important to point out at the beginning of a podcast like this, with such a grand ambition as to look at the whole order of society itself and how it might be improved, it's important to say that Dr. Steiner didn't really ask or want anyone to believe him about anything. Rather, he wanted them to test what he was saying with their own intellects and verify it, because only on such a basis will really positive change be made at all. And I think in the 100 years since his death, that statement has been proved again and again and again. Political movements, economic movements, cultural movements, Dr. Steiner might say, really can get nowhere from here unless they are based on a solid foundation of quite simply being true. Now, I'm not talking about some philosophical concept of truth, something you might have read in the 1700s or 1800s, you know, questioning what's real and what's not, etc. Although, you know, esotericism in general, Steiner's work, does have to go there. You have to address those questions in that way, but that's really not what we're going to be doing here. While there are certainly proofs to be found, pathways to be found, I probably should say, to what is true and what is not true, and the limitations on what one can even say about what is true or what is not true, and from all the different perspectives one would have to say it from, that is all to be found in Dr. Steiner's work, known more or less as spiritual science. Or some might call it anthroposophical science, but spiritual science is just as good a term and probably a better one, because there's anthroposophy itself. Anthroposophists really have no claim on spiritual science per se. It's just Dr. Steiner's own particular branch of, you might say, his own particular work in the field of esotericism, which was quite popular in his day, the early 1900s. It's more or less fallen out of favor now. For the time being, we should say, these things don't really stop or start. They come and go at different times. And in Dr. Steiner's day, esotericism was a, you know, fairly popular subject. So who was Dr. Steiner in a nutshell? Well, we might get into that in a future episode, but because this is an introductory episode to the Threefold Social Order, I'm going to limit my comments and remarks to why people should pay attention to what he has to say about the Threefold Social Order. And first, perhaps, just what the Threefold Social Order is. The Threefold Social Order is kind of what it sounds like, a new idea, a new approach to ordering human society, human life, in a new and different way. And in its simplest term, Dr. Steiner might say, currently, in the West at least, we order society in a more or less ad hoc way, or one might say a one-fold way, a kind of mix and match of this and that approach that amounts to one giant confused mess that's led by some kind of charismatic individual in the West. That might be Donald Trump, it might be Bill Clinton. I don't know if I would call Joe Biden charismatic by any stretch, but in each Western country, Western modern country, we might say at this stage, you have some kind of charismatic or at least elected or rich or something individual who is for a certain amount of time more or less leading a kind of confused mess of politics, economics, culture, all these forces, you might say, that flow in and out of human society, that weave within and without of our lives constantly. You have one person heading this up. Now, of course, you know, that's not totally accurate, and that is why we have to approach all these things from many perspectives, because For example, in the United States, we have a threefold approach already in the makings, what the founding fathers intended to be, probably a more threefold approach than it actually is. But you have the judiciary, and you have the legislative, and then you have the executive. So already baked into the cake, at least in the United States Western model, is kind of a germinal threefold approach, probably because it was founded by Masons, and they would have no doubt known that really a threefold approach was the only, had the only potential for any real lasting success towards a goal one might frame abstractly as a free society. More on that at some point later. But people hopefully won't think I'm promoting Masonry by any stretch. It's unlikely I will ever promote Masonry, although I also won't just blindly sandbag them like many people do who just frankly don't understand what the whole thing's about. And I'm not casting any blame on such people because their whole idea is to keep themselves secret. So, you know, it's kind of their own doing that everyone thinks they're bad news. But having said that, they are in their own way, at least today, a good deal of time, bad news, and will be for some time. So anyway, more on that at some point in the future. But in other Western countries, I suppose you have like Canada, for example, with its kind of unique systems of governance. You have France, you have Britain, you have, you know, Germany, EU in general. These are all following a kind of parliamentary or elected official model where someone gets elected to lead, to have influence over a body of people for some time, whether it's a smaller influence over or a larger one, say an MP or a prime minister or a president or a congressman or a judge. Basically, people who are believed to be qualified and credible and decent, although we all know, perhaps, you know, much of the time they're demonstrably not. These people get put in positions of power and they're expected to lead the cultural, the economic, and the legal lives that we all live in our own threefold way, which brings us probably to the best way to represent what a threefold social order is. It's a social order based on what the human being really is. Now, what I've just said is that the human being, all of us, in other words, that's us, we're human beings, we live constantly in a more or less threefold way. Another way to say that is we have three kind of primary things going on in our lives all the time. Now, could you expand that out into 9, into 12, into 7? Sure, you could. You could look at it a whole bunch of ways. But since ancient times and in modern times and in future times, it will, although it's not quite widely recognized now, it will be recognized that three is more or less the most balanced, stable, reasonable way to frame things, and it's just a way of framing things. Now, how do we do that when we're talking about human beings or human life, political life, all these things? Well, you break it down to its fundamental three components. You have thinking. That's something we all do. If you're listening to this podcast now, if you weren't thinking, you'd just be hearing a bunch of sounds and maybe running around in the woods somewhere freaked out because you wouldn't be a human being. You'd just, in that case, you'd be an animal or a creature without the ability to think at all, to recognize language, to recognize words. So that is more or less a primary component of being a human being. It's the ability to think. That's one primary facet we all live in every day. We all think every day. It's very difficult not to think, regardless of whether you're very intelligent, whether you're not very intelligent. Doesn't matter. If you can think, you are a human being. And if you can't, then, you know, either you've had a massive brain trauma, in which case you're an injured human being, or there's something, a problem at birth, in which case, you know, there's something else going on there. But what I'm saying is what characterizes us as human beings is the ability to think. And that's one of the three things that make us human beings. Two is the ability to feel. Now, we all feel things, some more, some less. Maybe a scientist is, you know, a bit more objective, a bit less touchy-feely about things, but they still have feelings. Say an artist, a dancer, a painter, likely they feel things a whole lot more than, say, a scientist would, but not necessarily. But as a whole, you'd find artists go through life feeling things very deeply. But that's just kind of the extreme example. We all feel things all the time. That really doesn't need to be proven, because, you know, we've all had those, we all have every day things we like slightly more, we like slightly less. That's not a function of our thinking. That's a function of our feeling. The reason we say we don't like something is because it doesn't feel too good. Okay, so that's thinking and feeling. The next thing we're talking about is what they call in Dr. Steiner's day, willing. Now, it's a fine word today. There's no reason not to use the word willing, but someone might, you know, substitute it with doing or something like that. But basically, willing is pretty good. I'm going to stick with it. We have thinking, feeling, and willing. And willing, this last three-part component we're looking at, is more or less what it sounds to be. It's things you do. It's not thoughts you think, right? You can sit in a chair and think for 3 hours and not really will anything outwardly in the world. You can feel something that whole time too. Let's say you're not thinking, you're just sitting there, you know, experiencing all these feelings, listening to some music or whatever you're doing, you're having all these feelings. But once you put those thoughts and those feelings into action, once you do something out in the world, you are now engaged in willing. You're consciously working at something, trying to get something done. In other words, if you're not merely thinking and if you're not merely feeling, what you're doing in some way or another is willing. You're working towards something. You're putting something into action, into motion. Now, of course, one's never just thinking or just feeling or just willing, at least not much of the time. If you're walking around anywhere, which would be an act of willing, you're probably thinking about where you're going. And you're probably feeling some way about why you're going there, what you're going to do. So in fact, Dr. Steiner often said, you can't really get to realistic concepts, true concepts about anything without learning to think about many things, many different variables all taking place at the same time, which leads us back to the question we asked a little while ago about what is true. And, you know, without getting to the nitty-gritty of what is true and what's not true and philosophically nutting out those finer points, what we can say is Dr. Steiner would simply say that if you're going to understand reality and what is true, you have to learn to understand kind of many variables, many perspectives. This whole idea that we can sum up reality into one thing, one easily digestible small snapshot, is a complete and total illusion. It's a lie. And that's one of the reasons we are stuck with kind of a backwards, self-serving, for many people, social order as is. And even without getting into the self-serving nature of, say, politicians and this and that, all, you know, we can say quite demonstrably that the social order we have is not really geared towards benefiting human beings. I mean, that'd be a stretch to say it was. I think at best we can say we're all trying to figure out how to simply live amongst one another, cooperate, etc. And we're at the beginning of that journey, but not the end. I don't know if it will ever end, but we can say we'd be making progress when you have a society built around people living not only harmoniously, but also thriving, you know, doing well, who like their lives, not people running around trying to figure out how to, you know, make ends meet or how to get off their pill addiction or how they're going to deal with this sexual this or that, whether it's their own feelings, whether it's other people's. You know, this frames a lot of our thinking today, is all about sexuality or maybe war. You know, if you live in the Middle East, if you live in some parts of the world, you spend your life wondering if you're going to wake up tomorrow, if your relatives are going to be alive tomorrow. This is, of course, an absurd way to live. I mean, I could go on. You know, some people are just mind-bogglingly absurdly wealthy, and some people are mind-bogglingly poor. You know, I don't think anyone would agree, even the wealthiest people, that that's normal. I'm not The threefold social order, I should say, because we'll have to deal with a lot of economic issues, is certainly not about creating utopian society where everyone has the same amount of stuff, and that is somehow called, you know, fair or equitable. Well, you know, Dr. Steiner said that that is not really a realistic concept in itself, or even perhaps a desirable one. Now, why? Why would this not be desirable to set up a utopian community where everyone has the same amount of stuff? Well, that's not, I mean, that's only utopian to a few people, and it's not really realistic, I think, to anyone who can think clearly. People are different. Everyone's different. This is a big part of Dr. Steiner's ideals, is that human beings, each one of us, is a unique, an absolutely unique being and needs to be treated as such. Whether it's education or politics or finance or whatever, that for Dr. Steiner, the goal is to not lose our individualities, you know, sacrifice being an individual to have this kind of theoretical harmonious life of state where each person, you know, just lives how the state says because they've squashed their individuality into nothingness. That's probably the opposite of his goal. Dr. Steiner's goal, if I'm going to put words in his mouth, is to have each one live out their true expression, their truest expression of individuality in the highest sense of the word. Now, I don't mean everyone, you know, free-for-alling, doing whatever they want and saying, oh, that's, I'm being an individual, you know, I'm killing the guy next door because I love his wife and I want to take over his house and property. You know, I'm an individual. I deserve that. Obviously, that's nonsense. There you have individuality has gone way, way, way too far. So what we'll see with this, with the threefold social order, is a balancing of extremes, a coming to terms with extremes. And that's why it is a threefold social order, is because really in life, we are all, as human beings and as citizens, wherever you live, fundamentally coming to terms with a kind of a threefold existence. On one, we have economic life. We all live in some kind of economic reality, regardless of where you are. Even if you're in a, you know, socialist communist country, you live in some kind of economic reality. You have to deal with that. And in Dr. Steiner's view, that's a primary thing. We can associate that with the human being portion of willing. Now, why willing, you might say? Well, because if you're a human being walking around, you're burning up calories, you're achieving something, you're plowing, you're, even if you're sitting at your desk, if you're a manager at work, you're working on things, you're trying to achieve objectives, you're willing things. And that is ultimately pretty much all the economy really does. It's meant to get things done. It's the economy is a system of exchange of values. You could call it kind of an exchange of human energies. You know, you can give someone $100 and hire them for an hour or two or wherever you live and how much $100 is worth, you can, you know, get them to dig a hole in your backyard if you're not up to the job. So you might say economic life is a way for us to store up the ability to get things done. It's a will mechanism, if you like. It's the world, it's the way the world wills itself to get things done. And very much like the human being has a digestive apparatus that all it does is digests and gives us, you know, builds our bodies, gives us the energy to do things. If you stopped eating, you'd run out of energy very quickly and you couldn't do much. In other words, your willing would go, you know, down the toilet. So you need to keep eating, digesting, to keep going as a human being, to keep getting things done. And similarly, we need an economy. We need an economic system if we're going to get things done in the world. That's just baked into the cake of reality at present and will be for a long, long time. Nothing really lasts forever. So if we look thousands of years into the future, you know, we may be doing this thing in a very, very different way. But to be honest, that's so far away, it really doesn't merit thinking about. Okay, so that's willing, and that is economic life. So let's tie those two things together, but let's move on now to feeling. Now, as I said before, as human beings, we're all feeling things all the time, right? Even if, you know, it's not a very strong feeling, if it's kind of a something you don't even really notice that much, you're sitting at work, you're looking at the computer, you're sending an email, you're looking at your phone, you're feeling something, even if it's in the background, even if you're not at a concert, even if you're not, you know, with your partner, you're feeling things all the time. And in life, our everyday life, as a people, as a society, we are all constantly more or less doing the equivalent of feeling something, but on a much larger scale. What I would like to say here is we are all constantly living within parameters that we don't really control. We call these parameters laws. Now, how would someone equate feelings with laws? That sounds a bit strange, you might say. Well, it totally makes sense once you get to understand Steiner's view is not based on weird theories and strange, you know, just made up nonsense. It's based on truth and reality. So what I'm going to ask you to do before I go into this is kind of suspend your disbelief that such things are impossible to know, because I assure you they're not. Esotericists have known this kind of thing for thousands of years. And that's why a threefold conception of the world has been around since time immemorial. Even if you go back to 10,000 years ago in ancient India, they were talking about Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu. If you were talking about ancient Egypt, they'd be talking about Horus and Isis and Osiris. In the West, we say the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Those are our most ancient conceptions of reality itself, albeit religious conceptions, which does not mean they're any more or less real than anything else, as strange as that sounds. But they're the way we as human beings cognized reality a long, long time ago. And similarly, we're going to have to do the same thing now in a non-religious context. Not because we're bowing to some kind of ancient wisdom we don't understand, but because we do understand why they did what they did. And they didn't do what they did because they were fools who believed in made-up stories. They did what they did because they could pierce to the heart of reality in ways we cannot. And there is really no other way to say it. I'm not going to beat around the bush. This is what the basis of reality is. It's understanding things as they really are, because there are individuals, all of us, if you go back far enough, who can pierce through the veil, so to speak, of the kind of matrix illusion that we all live in. And without turning this into a weirdo conspiracy podcast, what I'm going to say is I am, when it comes time to talk about esoteric concepts, I'm not going to shy away from it. Neither am I going to build this up into some esoteric exploration that most people just won't understand and really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, if it's in you to search for those things, to study them, great, go do it and meet in your small groups or meditate on it yourself. But it's not the goal of this podcast to get into great big esoteric discussions, at least not at present. Maybe that'll change in the future. If there is a real need for it, if people can actually make use of such concepts to get something practical done in the world in a safe and healthy way, then sure, maybe we'll go there. But for right now, we're going to stick to talking about the creation, the development, the ongoing nurturing of a new way of doing things as human beings, of relating one to another. And to do that in a true way, in a threefold way, we're going to have to base all we do on reality. And the deepest layer of reality from a certain point of view that we can get to right now as human beings is a threefold perspective or a threefold understanding or a threefold outlook on who we are and what we are, what we're doing here, what existence really is, what reality is, all those things you could put into the same pile of understanding the world around us or the cosmos or the universe or existence, etc. I could go on and on, but why? Okay, so now back to feeling. This time we'll actually round it up and move on to thinking. So we walk through the world feeling things constantly in the same way as we walk through the world surrounded by laws. We don't think about it, but we're constantly making decisions or not making decisions based on the legal ramifications of what we do. We grow up this way, so we don't really think about it. It's kind of ingrained into us, some more than others. Some are very, very conscious of what they can and can't do and, you know, complaining about it no end. Others are on the other side of the spectrum and kind of assume that, you know, there should be some kind of authority over us and they basically cower in fear of anything other than a life lived under the thumb of someone, you know, smarter than them or greater than them or more responsible than them. So I'm going to avoid going to either extreme, those of the people who basically refuse to take responsibility for themselves and want to put it on someone else, anyone else almost, to decide for them what's right or what's wrong by calling it legal or illegal. That's one extreme. Or going to the other extreme of people who think that really anything should be legal. You know, some people will say, so long as you don't hurt someone else. But as we'll soon see, that gets into a whole nother bag of how you can hurt someone else and how you can't, because it's not nearly as simple of a situation as saying, you know, did I punch someone or not? These days, you can lose your job, you can get censured, you can do this or that for saying you simply disagree with someone about some aspect of their life, some aspect of how they choose to live. If you disagree with it, then, you know, you don't deserve your job, or you might get fired, or you might lose your position. Maybe you get sent to jail in the UK. You know, if you disagree strongly enough with someone about some aspect of their life, you could get sent to jail. I mean, forget about protesting about certain things today. If you do that, you know, you could face jail time. So anyway, those are two extremes about hurting people or not hurting people according to the laws and legalities of today. Now, how does this relate to feeling? Now, although you probably don't think about it much, something in you, something like a higher judiciary, something like a higher self is constantly telling you, yeah, you know, maybe getting plastered tonight would be fun, but it's probably not a good idea because you have a test tomorrow. And, you know, it's probably not smart. So in other words, some part of you, let's call it the lower self, would really like to do something that feels good, but some other thing, let's call it a higher self, is restricting you in a way. Now, of course, you can go against these things. You can, as many people do in, you know, university, they don't listen to their, or, you know, late teens, early 20s, people aren't known for listening to their conscience, to their higher self. They're known for experimenting with giving free rein to the lower self, having just, you know, left home for the first time, where probably they were kept within some kind of confines, you know, morally, or we could say their feelings for what people should do and what shouldn't do, if they're reasonable human beings, were more or less regulated for them by their parents or their family, or, you know, in some cases, the culture at large. But in some way or another, we learn to regulate our feelings as human beings. And if you look carefully at it, that is what the law does for us as a whole, as a society. There are some people who would walk around naked most of the time, so long as the weather permitted. We call them naturists or nudists or whatever. They don't mind at all being seen, you know, in the raw all the time by anyone who wants to see them. Yet the vast majority of us don't feel that that's something we want to see. We don't, in other words, our feeling life is impacted strongly by, our feeling life is impacted strongly by a bunch of people walking around naked all the time. If that were a reality we woke up in, we would probably move somewhere else. Now, of course, I'm not going to get into the whole thing about how, you know, it's a right of people to dress how they want and who's, or to wear no clothes at all, and who's to say that, you know, there shouldn't be a colony of a whole town of nudists somewhere. In a threefold social order, if you had enough people who wanted to do that, they probably could. No reason they couldn't. The threefold social order is built around not only bringing out the kind of true identity, the true individualities of each person, but also of each group, you know, of groups. And it does this in a way that balances extremes to allow for each person to live out their own best life, if you will, to the greatest extent possible, but also balances the fact that other people need to be taken into consideration. So we're looking at the two extremes here and trying to find a balance point. Okay, so now this is why the feeling life, if you like, equates to the legal life in the threefold social order, is because people establish laws really not based on thinking alone, not even by a long stretch, and not by what's economically expedient, not by a long stretch either in that way. So I've just defined two extremes, one, thinking on one side, and two, willing or economic life on the other. So we have something in between these two extremes as human beings. In between our mere thinking and our mere willing, we have feeling. And that feeling is constantly regulating those two concepts, those two poles, I should say. They're not really concepts, they're realities. So you have your thoughts as a human being, and you have your will as your human being, what you do. And in between those is more or less where we live in our feeling life. Now, you can't say we live totally in our feeling life because we're a lot more than feelings. You can't say we live totally in our thoughts because we're a lot more than robots, which is kind of what you would be if you were just thought with no feeling. And we're not living in our wills, which would make us kind of zombies. No thoughts, no feelings, just walking around doing things with absolutely no knowledge of what we're doing, or sleepwalkers. All right, so now for the last piece of this puzzle, let me summarize quickly. We've done thinking, feeling, and willing as core components of the human being. And as for their social corollary, I might say, we've talked about economic life and legal life. Now, the last piece of this three-legged stool, you might say, is cultural life. So what do I mean by cultural life? Well, perhaps one way to go about this is to say anything that's not purely economic, i.e. people doing things to make things, to provide goods and services, etc., or that aren't legal, you know, laws, Congress, legislature, judicial, executive, all those things, anything that aren't those two things wind up in the category of culture. And it's a very large bucket. No larger, I don't think, than the other two. Really, it's probably not as easy to nutshell culture as it is to nutshell economics or economic life and legal life or political life as we know it today. Everything else really, though, falls into the realm of culture. What do I mean by everything else? Well, as we walk around as human beings, we're constantly surrounded by artistic impulses, by cultural impulses. We're also surrounded from the time we're very young, and if we stay awake to it, till the time we're very old, by educational impulses. And of course, there's a lot more. We all speak different languages. Language is really an aspect of culture. It's certainly not an aspect of economics, and has nothing to do with legalities. And think about how deeply the language you speak or a language is affect your life. I might remind you that Charlemagne said, if you learn another language, it's like gaining another soul. Now I'm paraphrasing. I don't think that's verbatim, but it's pretty close. And what he was saying was, those who take the time and trouble to learn how to speak in a different way and ultimately think in a different way, because words ultimately shape our reality. I'm not going to go off on that tangent right now. But if you do that, you learn to be, if you like, in a different way. So language is an extremely important part of our culture. And perhaps now it will make sense to you why whole people's, whole nations have risked everything they are simply to preserve their language. Because to them, language is who they are. If you force them to learn a different way of speaking, it would feel like you were taking away selfhood. In other words, they are who they are. We feel like who we are, I should say, because we speak and we think in a certain way. And speech and culture and language and art, all these things go very strongly together. If you think back to when you were young growing up, what's the most defining thing about your childhood? Probably everything you learned, whether it's from your parents, your family, your church, your community club, you know, the scouting group, whatever you did, that was all education. And of course you have grade school and junior high or secondary or high school or tertiary, you know, however you call it, wherever you live. All these things are not really usually done for modern most human beings, not only Western human beings, but most places in the world. Those things aren't considered finished until probably your mid to late teens or early 20s. And some people go on until they're, you know, till whenever. Some people never stop learning. So education, if you like, culture, art, language, all the things we do that aren't purely task-focused economics or legal structures, which are a kind of a framework, a necessity for all of us getting along, if you're not doing one of those two things, you're more or less in the realm of culture. What do people do when they're not working? And assuming they're not involved in politics in a big way or involved in lawsuits or they're not a judge or anything, they're probably not thinking a great deal about what's legal and what's not legal. They're doing everything else. They're entertaining themselves. They're learning things. They're out hiking. They're, you know, gardening. They're painting. These days, they're wasting a whole lot of time on social media. There's all these things qualify as culture. It's, you know, I don't want to say it's the defining thing about being a human being, but one could, you know, I don't know if I'd try to defend that, because in my mind, we are ultimately three things, but we spend most of our conscious life really not thinking a great deal about the law and more or less just getting by, I suppose, with whatever job you're doing. And the rest of the time is devoted towards cultural pursuits in some way or another. Our time is spent under some kind of cultural umbrella. And if you think about what your life would be like in a different culture, you know, if you grew up, if you're a Westerner, if you grew up in the East, your life would be very, very different. And the difference would be your culture. You know, you learned a different way. You learned a different way of being growing up in Japan than you did in the United States, or in Singapore than the UK, or wherever. And the reason being, once again, there were people around you who taught you a different way. You learn to speak a different way, and in learning to speak a different way, or I should say you learn to speak in a certain way, and learning to speak and read in a certain way, you learn to think in a certain way. And because people who speak and think in a certain way create a certain kind of environment to live in, a shared common environment, then they form a shared culture, which more or less determines what you do with your life in a lot of ways. It's not impossible to break out of your culture. In fact, it's probably a pretty good thing to expand your horizons, but you're probably never going to get away, you know, in toto from the way you were raised. And there's really nothing wrong with that. But anyway, look at us now at 43 minutes on this introductory episode. I've managed not to lose my voice, which is a good omen, I think. To sum up, what we have been talking about is Dr. Rudolf Steiner's take on what social developments, you could say, what political developments, if we want to use that broad umbrella, really have to come about if our society as a whole is not going to completely crap out, is not going to fall apart, is not going to grow more and more inequitable, more and more dangerous, more and more, for lack of a better word, gloomy, depressing, dark. In other words, if we're going to avoid falling into a kind of abyss, as Dr. Steiner said, those are his words, then we are going to have to take a very decided step precisely at this point and avoid that abyss through consciously looking at the threefold nature of reality itself, which is an ancient, esoteric, or I could say spiritual concept, which means nothing more or less than to say a concept that derives from the heart of reality, which, if only by inference, you will have had to say to yourself by this point, Dr. Steiner is saying he is capable of seeing. And that is correct. He did say that, not as a unique possession of his, but as one of many initiates who have spanned the ages for thousands of years of humankind, bringing ideas like this for us, for the rest of us, to take up, to understand, to move forward. Now, I'm not going to fall into the trap of putting Dr. Steiner on some kind of pedestal like many people who have been highly influenced by his works do, making him, you know, almost some kind of, demigod. I will say that he had very profound and unusual abilities that can be perfectly well explained and even experienced by those who will take the time to study and learn what he talked about. What you will find if you do that is no statement he made is unfounded. He is not some kind of religious leader. He is not making divine claims. He is building a foundation of facts on a greater foundation of facts. Nothing he does anywhere is not factual. It's all factual. It's called spiritual science for a reason. It's not called spiritual beliefs or spiritual dogma. It's called spiritual science. Because everything he did is perfectly attestable or perfectly testable by anyone who will put in the required time and effort. Now, granted, that could take many, many years, decades, or lifetimes to get to the point where you can do what he could do, but it may not. He's not the only one who did this. He's just the most modern and best example of a true initiate, someone who could answer pretty much whatever question you asked him, and he did. To my knowledge, there is no question that was ever put to Dr. Steiner that he couldn't answer. And some questions, as he said, take 20 years or 30 years or who knows how long to answer. But as he said, all questions are answerable to the human being who will take the time and trouble, whether it takes weeks, months, years, decades, or lifetimes to pursue those answers. And once again, I'd like to say to those who are encountering Dr. Steiner for the first time, this is all something you can learn about firsthand for yourself. I have absolutely no connection with the Anthroposophical Society in Germany or America or wherever they are. I've never been a member. It's unlikely that I ever will be. I've had absolutely no contact with any kind of formal organization of any of these groups. I have met maybe a handful of anthroposophists in the course of my lifetime, and with none of them have I ever really had any lasting kind of relationship at all. It's just been kind of happenstance. And that's all I have to really say about that. So lest you be thinking I'd be agitating for any kind of anything other than the threefold social order itself, and a deeper understanding of reality itself, or Dr. Steiner's work itself, you'd be mistaken. I have the greatest interest and most ardent and warm enthusiasm for agitating for those things, for the threefold social order, for understanding Dr. Steiner's work, and for getting to the heart of reality itself. And it came time to do this as I'm getting ready to take a trip, so I'm going to record this intro episode and then a bunch more that will start off dealing with a subject that we can't avoid in the threefold social order, which is economic life. So I've just talked about economic life, legal life, and cultural life. And we're not going to start with cultural life. That's a very big question. We're not going to start with legal life, although we'll have to address it at some point. We're going to start with economic life because that's probably the most simple, and it's also probably the most taken for granted among the three branches. People just think, oh, that's just economic life. That's just my job. Well, you know, this may be the first surprise you have on this journey, but what you do for work, what you do with your willing life is probably the deepest part of your being. Now, once again, Steiner never made blanket statements like that, so I'm going to have to check myself. I'm going to have to make sure I'm not giving you the wrong impression by saying that somehow your work life matters more than anything else or is deeper than anything else. But one could say from a certain point of view that what you spend 8 hours a day doing for 30 years, for 40 years, for however long you work, winds up impacting you more than anything else. You may not be conscious of it. You may not be aware of it. What's going to matter a whole lot is what you did in your willing life, in your economic life. Anyway, we'll leave it on that suspenseful note. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you stop by again.